Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and it's a cold one, Monday here in Brooklyn. And this is really exciting, though, because we've got a guest on the line. She's a San Francisco-based PhD in neuroscience, actually, but she is the author of Summer Tomato, a blog all about health, nutrition, lifestyle, food, cooking, and lots of good stuff. It's Daria Rose. How are ya?
Good. How are you?
Good. Thanks so much for joining.
Absolutely. It's exciting. You guys freezing out there, huh?
It is absolutely freezing. Yes. I'm very jealous right now. But such exciting times for you right now. You had The Foodist, your book that came out last year. It's called The Foodist, Using Real Food and Real Science to Lose Weight Without Dieting, sort of the anti-dieting book, if you will.
Is that right?
And it did, you know, it's a great title. Lots of copies going out there. I hear, you know, The Foodist has become your, like, kind of catchphrase, too. And it's really exciting. And tell me about these pictures I've seen floating around lately with you and First Lady Michelle Obama.
Yeah. Yeah, that was random. Actually, a friend of mine invited me because she was going to be in town, and it was a really small group. Mostly women, and we just had a fantastic discussion with the First Lady about health and habits, and, you know, I was really impressed with how she grasped how hard it is to get people to change, and she understood that it was more than just, you know, education or, yeah, you know, giving people access to good food. She was like, it's really tough. If you give people access to something and they don't know how to use it, they won't change their habits.
Right.
And, like, habits is really what I like to focus on.
Yes.
In terms of getting people to eat better, because in my experience with my work, that's what I've found is people's hardest, like, the hardest thing for people is not, like, knowing what's healthy,
mm-hmm,
but, like, actually, like, making that decision to eat a healthy meal day after day after day. So,
right. Yeah. Sort of like breaking a new routine. And it's totally
exactly
integrated with a lot of different aspects of your everyday life. That's amazing, though. So you had a chat, and I can. It sounds like you guys are, you know, of the same sort of like drive here. I'm trying to get people to eat more healthy in a very practical, you know, just consistent way. So congratulations.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Thanks.
And also, I would also add, because this show is all about words and literature, and your blog, Summer Tomato, which is how many years old now?
Oh, gosh. I launched it in early 2009.
Okay.
So, almost that. 5 years.
Okay. Oh, that's exciting. 5-year anniversary. Your blog is so good. Like, every time I look at a blog post title, I'm like, I totally need to know more about this. And congrats. And it was also, I just noticed it was named one of the best websites in Time Magazine of 2011. Not
yeah,
just like food sites, but like websites. So that's pretty, that's pretty awesome. Congrats.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, you know, words, it's funny you bring that up, because that's one of the things I talk to people about all the time. It's that, like, you know, if you're, like, for instance, like, there's plenty of research that says if you use the word healthy to describe a food, like, 90% of people are going to assume that it tastes bad and isn't very filling.
So, no kidding.
You know, one way you can make, you know, eat better and eat healthy and get other people to be on board instead of, like, judging you is to just not use that word. And so, you know, I've realized that it's really essential to choose your words correctly if you're talking about health, because so many people are just turned off by it. And so I'm glad you like my headlines.
That is so funny. And now that you mention it, I probably do mention like healthy. Like when I say, oh, this tastes healthy, I mean it in a derogatory way. So, what is a good way to say, like, what are some good foodist approved words instead? Like nutritious, wholesome?
It's just, I just like steer away from the whole like morally driven, good health thing, because it's just such a turnoff for so many people. So I like to focus on the attributes of the food itself, because real food that's like, you know, like in season, delicious produce, or like really good quality food that is what is healthy, it is really delicious. So I focus on the flavor, you know, I say the taste. You can also, it's really tasty, it's really delicious, or really juicy. Like a really good peach is going to be really juicy and sweet, and you can use those attributes instead of calling it a healthy peach. You can bring up words that reflect some sort of nostalgia. Like everybody loves grandma's apple pie, right?
That's just
apple pie. So you can, if you cook something in a special way, or if there's a cool backstory behind one of your ingredients, you can share that, and that will get people excited about it, even if it's broccoli or whatever.
Totally. So it's about like evocative meanings, like summer tomato, for instance, the name of the blog, which is so fun and like friendly too. All right. So I noticed that you had a few blog posts about, how to stay fit in the winter, but, it's the middle of winter. And I don't know about you, but I eat such heavy foods. Like I'm eating like bagels and pastas and like meat sauce. And I think it has to do with the dearth of seeing all these, beautiful, colorful summer tomato and zucchini varieties, that are at least in the Northeast, not in season here, or just maybe not as delicious looking or juicy or at their prime in the conventional store because it wasn't grown locally. Do you have any tips for like how to like eat? And I hate to say the word healthy now, but how to eat more veggies basically in the winter when there's like gross looking dirty kale and cabbages. I don't know. It's limited. It's limited.
It is limited. There are vegetables that are in season during the winter. They don't tend to be beautiful vegetables, but they have better flavor in the winter. For instance, like turnips and cabbage and, certain winter vegetables actually get much, much sweeter as it gets cold. So, for instance, like radishes, like certain kinds of radishes can get really spicy in certain times of year to the point where I can't eat them. But like, like a daikon, for instance, can be like the big Japanese radishes.
Those are good.
Can get really, really spicy, but they're delicious this time of year. What's great about the root vegetables and those heartier vegetables is you actually can cook them in ways that with those heavier dishes, in a roast, or, you can roast them and make it feel warm and really filling and really nurturing.
Really
but you're
savory.
Still
yeah.
getting those veggies and you can kind of do both things at once. And I don't think you should ever, say you shouldn't eat pasta and bagels, but if you want to add the veggies too, just remember that they're delicious under the ugly skin.
Yeah, I guess like maybe it's just like this mental connotation of like eating something raw, like a salad that just doesn't really seem to happen too much in winter with turnips.
Totally.
Or I guess
and
radishes.
That's fine.
Yeah.
I think we like to have things that are warm and like hearty this time of year because, I think our instincts are to tell us that it's cold, you need to stay warm, you need to stay nourished because you could starve, you have to eat things that are like dense and like calorie dense. And that's fine, as long as you are still eating the vegetables too.
Cool. So I was very intrigued by a post that you wrote about juicing recently, and how it's sort of like this religion that a lot of people are devout about. And, some people take it as far as, drinking juice only, or at least going on a cleanse. And you tried a cleanse and you were like, I'm just hungry.
Right. There's not a lot of science to support the cleanses. I mean, I know that I've talked to people that swear by it. I would say that it's largely a placebo effect for some people, and then also, you know, if you aren't eating a lot of vegetables normally and you start consuming, like, all those nutrients, I can imagine that you would feel great. But
I see.
But, like, if you, like, I recommend people just eat healthy all the time.
Right.
And if you do that, then, you know, a juice isn't going to be, like, this life-changing thing.
To me, it almost sounds like a sort of no-brainer way to get your greens in and like, kind of eat all these healthy carrots and stuff without having to prepare, chop, cook. But I guess that's good, I guess. But, you know, as you mentioned in your post, you just have to use tremendous amounts of vegetables, and then you lose a lot of the pulp, as they say, which is where a lot of the fiber is from vegetables, right? When you strain.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's just this tremendous amount of work, you know, and I love juice. Like, I have nothing against green juices. I think they're great. I wrote a post a couple years ago before this about buying a juicer because we were trying to juice at home for a while. And I just, you know, we've had three or four, and they're really expensive, and they're really hard to clean. And I just, like, my message is, like, I'm over this. Like, you know, I know that some people really enjoy it, but, like, for me personally, it's just way too much work because I also have to do all the shopping.
Yeah.
And, like, when I buy vegetables, like, okay, I'm juicing half of them, but I still need vegetables, like, for dinner.
Uh-huh.
So I'm like, I can't fit all these veggies in my fridge. So I'm fine just going to the juice bar and, like, getting my fix, you know, a couple times a week instead of, you know, forcing myself to do it all.
Yeah.
Every day. It's just too much for me. And like I said, I already eat really healthy, so I don't need that as to, like, you know, as like a nutritional supplement to my diet.
I'm curious about this fad, though, because, like, as you mentioned, like, first of all, getting a juicer, that's pretty expensive, and then storing all these fresh veggies that, you know, it all boils down to, like, you know, half a cup for
right.
a huge lot of it. It's expensive, and if you do go to the juice bar and get these nice fancy fresh juices, it's pretty expensive, like, you know, $5 to $10 to $12 a pop. So how did this
right.
fad even, like, catch on? Is it an elite fad? Is it a
there's these groups of people that have been juicing for decades and swear by it, and there's all sorts of myths around that, like, it cures cancer. Like, I seriously get people, like, on my blog saying that, like, yelling at me for criticizing juicing, saying, oh, well, you know, it cures cancer. It's like, seriously? Like,
the juice or maybe the veggies do? Because I can see the veggies,
Well, prevents, I mean, you know, like, yes, vegetables are associated with a decreased risk of cancer. It's not like a guarantee that you're not going to get cancer. It's not going to cure, like, it's not chemotherapy, you know, it's not, like, as magical thing. And so, I don't know, I think these rumors get started, and, you know, you know, people meet somebody and they swear by it, you know, it's just like any other diet fad. They're often expensive, and they're often cumbersome and, like, labor-intensive, but if somebody believes that it's going to, like, change their life, they're willing to go through that and believe to some extent that they're having this life-changing experience, even if it's just vegetable juice.
Well, you know, it sounds delicious anyway.
And I think it's great. I just, like, yeah, to the point where people give it a little more credit than it's probably deserved.
Yeah, I thought it was a little odd that there wasn't too much medical research done on the benefits or possible cons, too, of drinking a lot of juice all the time.
There's been a lot of studies about fruit juice, mm-hmm. and it's pretty clear that, like, too much fruit juice is bad because it's got such a concentrated source of I mean, you get the nutrients as well, which is great. So it's not, you know, some people compare it to soda. I don't think that's quite fair.
Mm.
But it is, you know, if you have fear of diabetes in your family or if you're trying to lose weight, like, too much fruit juice is definitely not as good as eating fruit. You know, that's what the science has said. So
mm-hmm.
I can't. But, like, you know, the juice fad, the way it's been going for the last couple of years, it just hasn't been going on long enough for the scientists to, like, really take note. I mean, most scientists, like, if you talk to them, they totally dismiss this as just a ridiculous fad.
Right.
So I don't think anybody's even, one of the reasons there hasn't been a lot of science is I think that the scientific community hasn't really taken it very seriously.
All right. So what does the foodist think about another huge fad right now, which is an anti-gluten fad? You know, there's a lot of pros and there's definitely a lot of pros about eating whole grains, ancient grains that happen to not have gluten, sure. But, you know, now that like so many people have these wheat intolerances or discomforts from gluten, do you think that there's any reason why folks who are not yet affected, any reason we should avoid gluten just to perhaps prevent any discomfort from happening or developing?
Yeah, probably not. There is definitely a percentage of the population that has a gluten, like can be very life-threatening gluten.
Celiac.
You know, allergies and intolerances. Right, celiac. It makes sense that there would be a few people with some sensitivities because gluten can be a bit of a gut irritant.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if your gut has been struggling for years with, you know, lots of processed food and you know, your gut flora, you know, that's why people take probiotics is to sort of get those bacteria that live in your gut, like, in the right balance for health. And if, you know, if your gut has been sort of been abused by a bad diet for a long time, I could see gluten being an irritant to some extent. That said, gluten is a food group in China. Like they, you know, they distill it and they make like food out of it. So it's not like it's innately bad for humans. It's fine.
Seitan, right? Seitan?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Like it's something that people eat. It's not like poison, which a lot of people think it is. But at the same time, like, there's no harm in seeing if it affects you. So, I mean, just cutting it out for a couple of weeks. I mean, the allergy tests that they give are not very sensitive. So really the only way to know if it affects you or not is to just not eat it for 6-8 weeks, something like that.
Okay.
And if you have problems and they go away, you've learned something about yourself. And then at that point you can try to add it back a little bit.
Okay.
You know, and then if you get a reaction, then you know that that's what was causing it. But most people, like kind of what you were hinting at, most people really probably don't need to worry about it, and they would just, if you're having stomach problems or something like that, it's probably something else. You're probably not chewing your food enough. You're probably not eating enough probiotics and fermented foods. You're probably, you know, eating more processed food than you should be. You know, things like that are much more common than like a gluten insensitivity.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I like how you like kind of have that whole like approach, whereas like maybe you're not eating enough fermented foods, which is definitely something you can eat a lot of in the winter now that I think about it.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those probiotic things that's really interesting that people in every culture in human history has eaten fermented foods to some extent, except it's sort of notoriously lacking in the Western diet.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I definitely think that's a more, you know, that's a very likely. I've had great help from eating like more kimchi and sauerkraut and things like that. It's like settled my stomach amazingly. So you know, I think people should, you know, figure out what works for them and try these different things.
Wow, cool advice! All right, we're gonna cut to a quick little musical interlude, and we'll be right back chatting more.
I ain't looking for no trouble tonight. I just want to hold you, ooh, so nice and tight. I ain't looking for no fight.
You're listening to Let It Go by the California Honey Drops on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Since 2001, Heritage Foods USA has sold pasture-raised, antibiotic-free heritage meats to restaurants and homes around the country. Our farmers raise their animals with care using traditional methods guaranteed to produce the very best tasting meat. Our pork breeds include Berkshire, Redwattle, Duroc, Gloucester Old Spot, Large Black, and Tamworth, and our beef comes from Piedmontese, Angus, Akiyushi, Belgian Blue, Highland, Simmental, and Belted Galloway cattle. We also carry a rotation of 24 rare breeds of heritage chicken, seasonal specialties like lamb, goat, geese, and of course, heritage turkeys. Visit us online at www.heritagefoodsusa.com or give us a call at 718-389-0985 to place your order today.
All right, we're back chatting with Summer Tomato, blog author, and also the author of The Foodist. It's Daria Rose. Hi. Still there?
Hi. All right. Yep.
All right. So I know it's a little late in the year for this, but maybe you've solidified some more ideas by now, early Feb. But do you have any food resolutions for this year? I don't know if resolution.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
So I'm not a big resolution person in general, because I've got this crazy personality type where I tinker with my life constantly, and I'm very, very interested in behavioral change. So if I have something I want to do, I dive in head first and I figure out what's preventing me from doing it, what could make it easier for me to do regularly, what the reward is so that I'm motivated to do it again, and all that. So that's how I food and health in general. So I don't really have very many health related ones. But one thing I would like to start doing, which I've never quite been able to integrate into my life, is cooking more from the cookbooks I have, because I have all these amazing cookbooks and I cook all the time, but I'm usually like exhausted, and you know, when you get home from work or whatever and you're just tired, and I just cook stuff I already know how to make because it's like super easy for me. So I wish I have this beautiful Japanese cookbook that I really wish I would dig into. So I hope I do.
Fun.
I haven't set my analytics on to how to get myself to do this yet.
any day could be a new year. But that sounds really fun. You know, broaden your horizons and a repertoire in cooking. And I love how you have like a very practical kind of like hit list on your blog about, you know, simple principles every day that you can do without like dieting, so quote unquote.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is to learn to cook. So, and continue learning to cook, it sounds like, is always a good way to kind of keep you motivated.
Totally.
At least, I think.
Yeah, people really struggle with cooking, I found. Like, obviously, there's a group of people that really loves cooking, and that's a great asset, especially if you're trying to eat healthier, because it's much easier to eat healthy if you can control everything, obviously, that's in your food. But so many people are out of the cooking habit. And Michael Pollan has written about this a lot. You know, we've been sort of sucked into this convenience type of society where we never learned to cook. You know, I didn't.
Yeah.
My parents didn't teach me how to cook. You know, and like half, you know, by my later childhood, they were, you know, popping the mac and cheese like all the other parents. But it's not as hard as people think. And this is one of the things that is hard to remember when you're trying to do something new, is that there's always this learning curve.
Mm-hmm.
And everything is harder if you've never done it before.
Right? Totally.
And everything's going to feel more time-consuming. Everything's going to feel more draining. But it's important to remember that the reason it feels that way is because you're bad at it. You know, it's because you've never done it before. But once you've done it a few times and that goes away, and then you are somebody who can cook dinner, why, like, just opening the fridge and seeing what you have and throwing something together, which is a great, great skill. And in a lot of ways, it saves you money, you know, because you don't have to go out all the time. And it actually, once you get pretty good at it, it's just as fast as, like, ordering takeout or, like, you know, as long as you already have the food in your fridge and you have a few basic skills to throw something together.
Absolutely. I think it's fun to see what people come up with when they learn to cook sort of later on in their life. Their early adulthood, we could say, and instead of like kind of taking on these, rituals that they had been ingrained with, I find that people use a lot more whimsy and creativity, and kind of just figure it out as they go along, which is
that's interesting.
Exciting.
I started cooking later in life. I was, must have been like 25 before I even like tried to cook anything, and I kind of cook like a. I said the other day, like a kamikaze method. Like, I'm just like, I'll like turn up.
Sorry,
the
stove. What?
Just, like,
so you went for it without knowing what was going to happen. It might die. It might be a disaster. Is that what
right,
you mean?
Right.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, like, I mean, I have no plan. Like, even if I have like a house guest
coming over,
I'll cook, and then I'll just like be like, I have no idea what I'm making. Like, I hope it ends up good.
What's the worst that can happen, though? I like that. That's take some risks now and then.
It's always worked out.
Nice. Cool. On the flip side of things to stick to or start doing this year, what are some foods that you think, or maybe habits, that you've identified as pretty bad and maybe we should avoid, if any? Even if they're common.
I really don't like to say bad. Yeah. But they're, you know, basically, the way I look at it is, we all have bad habits. Like, we all have, like, things we like that are not necessarily healthy or things we do that are not necessarily healthy. But, you know, the way I look at it is, first, get, like, the basic things that you do all the time on the, like, healthier side. For instance, breakfast, right?
Okay.
Like, a healthy breakfast is really easy to do. Like, oatmeal is really easy. Eggs are really easy. It takes just a couple of minutes. And, you know, people talk a lot about why breakfast is so important, whatever. The reason I think it's important is because then you have 30% of your meals for the day are healthy. Right?
Uh-huh.
That's a huge win. You know, it's like if you, like, kind of 80-20 principle your health, you know, pick the big win. So breakfast is a huge one.
Cool.
Lunch at work is a place where a lot of people slip up, and it's, you know, you forget what a big impact it has, but you're doing that 5 times a week. Right, that's another big percentage of your meals every week. So, you know, if you're having pizza all the time, like that's a problem. So what you can do is if you upgrade that meal, then suddenly you're like way doing better. And then you know, if you also manage to cook at home a few nights a week or maybe weekends or whatever, then if you want to, you know, when it's your anniversary or it's your friend's birthday party, you can go and you can have a piece of cake and not worry about it because you ate healthy most of the time the entire month. So, like, one, it's not even a slip up at that point, you know, it's
right.
Just like something budgeted
intentional, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah,
exactly.
All right. I'm excited about that because, like, you know, breakfast you mentioned is something I don't really think about too much. And if I do, it's usually like a bacon, egg, and cheese on a bagel or something like that. So, yes, that's a good one. I don't do that much, though. So
you're like mumbling under your breath.
That's an occasional intentional slip up. Yes, exactly.
Right.
So do you have any, plans to, now that, you know, Foodist has been out for a while, it did great. Do you have any plans to write another book?
Not yet. I'm still sort of in the Foodist mindset. I'm still just trying to get that message in front of as many people as possible.
Cool.
I'm definitely developing more of an interest in the behavioral change stuff that I mentioned because it's become such a prominent obstacle for people in the work I do. So, you know, at some point maybe I'll explore that more in a new book, but right now I'm gung-ho on the Foodist.
Awesome. That's so fascinating. And of course, Summer Tomato, the blog, is still going and going strong. It could be like 5 books in itself with how many posts are on there. So congratulations for that. And thank you so much for sharing the wise advice. That's about all the time we have for now. But everyone check out summertomato.com or check out The Foodist, the book on Amazon and wherever books are available. And thanks again, Daria. It was great having you.
Yeah, thanks so much, Kathy.
All right, have a good one. Thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.